Hi, my name's Elaine Bracci. I'm a public health nurse for the city of Stamford. And today I'm going to be presenting using resources in the community to effectively distribute H1N1 vaccine. Sorry. I would like to recognize the co-authors, Ann Fountain, Lynn Galgano, Olga Brown Vanderpool, and Johnny Lee, MD. I have no relationships to disclose. Learning objectives are to identify the value of community partnerships to respond to emergencies, explore different communication modalities to reach different groups in a population, and explore lessons learned in conducting mass vaccination clinics. I kind of have this graph to explain or give a timeline as to how we got into the second phase of the H1N1. In early March and early April, Mexico had the outbreaks. April 12th, there was another outbreak reported. April 17th, there was an atypical pneumonia. And April 23rd, there was positive H1N1. It followed into California, where there were two cases of febrile respiratory illness of two children in late March. And this eventually became a positive case of H1N1. And moving on. 2 days after the CDC announced the outbreak, the New York Health Department started to investigate flu-like symptoms in a prep school in Queens. This was a concern to us because Queens, New York, is about 38 miles from Connecticut. Within days, we heard reports of influenza-like illness in Connecticut. Residents that had traveled to Mexico recently were among the first cases, and they were actually college students on spring break. However, there was a widespread of illness among students in the schools, and there was a suspected outbreak of flu in children that had just returned from a trip to Washington, D.C. This is my favorite slide. Okay, school was dismissed at the end of June, and so we had very low flu activity for summer months. School resumed in late August, and 3 to 4 weeks later, we had flu, H1N1. At that time, in October, our governor, Rell, announced a statement that we would be getting intranasal flu, H1N1 vaccine for children ages 2 to 4 years old. Hotlines were established, and we started preparations and training in our health department. So this actually was the beginning of our experience of the second wave of the H1N1 pandemic. Just to give you, Just to give you an idea about how our health departments are in Connecticut. Connecticut's health department has 77 health departments and serving the entire state. There's no county structure for the public health, and in an effort to organize our mass vaccine clinics, the state created regions, and that's where we are in Region 1. And we took the lead, and during the H1N1, all local health departments were given support with the vaccine and supply distribution, but we got no support with any staff. And we have a staff of 6 public health nurses, but we also have about 32 school nurses that work under the Department of Health. So it was initially a challenge to vaccinate only the high risk and then the public in this diverse city of 120,000 speaking 58 languages bordering New York. And again, only being 38 miles outside of New York, and Stamford is also home to many corporate organizations. These are our community partners, Stamford Hospital, Board of Ed, EMS, City Department, Public Works, Risk Management, University of Connecticut, local businesses, and of course, the Connecticut Department of Public Health. Our partners had been meeting for about 2 years, and we communicated through alerts and through our alert network. And we kept them up to date with information from CDC and the State Health Department. Well, these are the vaccines, as you all know, and of course, every vaccine, there's four of them, and they actually were for different populations. And that created a problem, lots of questions, and of course, the biggest question was, which vaccine doesn't have dimerosal? It was huge. And we did receive the live attenuated first. We had a lot of public planning, changes, constantly changes, a lot of communication. We reached out to the providers to assess their interest in the capacity to provide the H1N1 influenza. We had 66 providers, for some reason, which we're not quite sure yet. There were very few private physicians that were interested and pre-registered for the intranasal vaccine. So we had constant updates, daily updates. Who received the H1N1? Well, for us, our first priority that came down through our state was that we would vaccinate 2 to 4 year olds with the intranasal vaccine. Okay, we did get vaccine, and we were the first to get the intranasal vaccine, and we needed to get the word out that we had limited supplies. We were focusing on prioritizing our population. We planned planning on strategic vaccine distribution, depending about the amount and allocation to the Stanford Health Department, the type of vaccine that was being allocated. We really never knew what we were going to get until about a week before, outside of the initial delivery of the intranasal. So it was difficult planning clinics, having people be aware to say, come, and we wouldn't have the vaccine. So we usually had about a 3-day leeway where we were able to get the word out. So the health department was the focal point of all things H1N1. We did receive the LAIV vaccine, and the Stanford Health Department was the only health department in the region distributing the intranasal vaccine. What we did is I have a travel clinic a few times a week, and since we had to maintain what we were doing, our normal duties, I canceled travel clinic because it really wasn't needed, and we developed that into an H1N1 clinic for 2 to 4 year olds by appointment. The first one was on October 19th. It was difficult because we had a hotline where we had one RN taking all the calls. If she was logging them in and she was doing screening over the phone. It was a task because when the children came for their appointments, we had to rescreen them. You know, parents were not giving the proper information. Some children had allergies, some children had just been immunized. I mean, we're talking 4-year-olds getting ready for kindergarten. They just had their MMR or their varicella. Parents were upset, they didn't understand. We gave them another appointment. It was just easier to do that. We also had children who had allergies to eggs, and I had one mom say, no, his allergist said he can have the intranasal, there's nothing in it. And I said, no. And so she had 2 children. We vaccinated one, and 4 weeks later, she came back for the second, and she said, thank you very much. So, you know, it was quite a job to get this accomplished. Anyway, we had, of our LAIV clinics, we actually ran them from October through December. We had 22 clinics, and we vaccinated over 1,400 children. Finally, we got the injectable vaccine in November, and we had both injectable and as well as the LAIV. So at that time, we utilized the lobby of the government center to set up to accommodate the next level of high risk. We ran 2 clinics. They're both held in the evening, and the town of Darien, who we were also covering, decided to run their own clinics. This clinic targeted pregnant women, household contacts, caregivers of infants less than 6 months of age, all children 6 months through 59 months, children 5 through 18 with high-risk medical conditions. We also saw some healthcare workers. And this was all accomplished really with our partners, the Stanford Police Department, who helped us with traffic control, foot control, and with our volunteers from the Stanford Hospital who helped with completions of forms and with our own health department staff. This clinic was manned with 12 nurses and we used a number system to keep the flow going. And with this particular two clinics, with a total of 8 hours, we gave 668 vaccines. We had a joint health department and hospital clinic. The community partnership with Stanford Hospital gave way to the utilization of the Tully Center, which is an outpatient diagnostic center, and we were able to use their site for our high risk. This clinic was staffed with the RNs from the hospital and also our PHNs. Hospital staff volunteered, and health department staff was there to help out with control of the crowds and the lines. And this clinic was active for one night, immunized pregnant women, high-risk children, and caregivers. 276 were vaccinated with only injectable. We had no intranasal there. Also, under the direction of Dr. Michael Perry, he's the chair of infectious diseases at Stanford Hospital, over 1,100 H1N1 vaccines were administered to employees at Stanford Hospital from 10:30 to January 1st, and it was accomplished through his roving cart, which was manned by an RN, and made sure all staff, if they wanted it, got their vaccines. And Stanford Hospital also conducted one independent community H1N1 clinic, which vaccinated over 800. Finally, the DPH announced that we could give vaccine to the community, to everyone. We used UConn as the facility for the first clinic, and we were able to vaccinate 888, and that was pretty good because we had 12 nurses in 4 hours. So, this was really accomplished with the support of all of our community partners. And we planned the site. We had the ingress and the egress. We used our signage. For the VIS statements, I had the yellow ones printed, the intranasal printed in yellow to match the number coordinate, and the injectable in pink, so we had good division of lines and organization. Signage was crucial in giving directions. We have our mobile medical van was used to reach the homeless and day laborers. This is often a hard population to reach, but we know where they are, and we can get to them with our van. We also used the train station for clinic for commuters coming in and out. It was very convenient for them. We continued our mass clinics at UConn for three clinics with a total vaccine administration of over 2,000. Our total vaccine administration was of this mass clinic was about 5,000. Communication with Stanford Health and Social Services. We communicated with the media, coordinated messaging with the Board of Ed, multilingual through the parent notification system through our schools, emergency notification system through Everbridge for our multilingual families. And we could let them know where the clinics were. Information we gave to private businesses, the H1 community forum with partners in Stanford Hospital, UConn, and Connecticut DPH. So getting the word out really was successful due to all of our partners. Lessons learned. Since so many of our physicians were reluctant to initially order the vaccine, we had to deal with reallocation, which is a whole nother piece, more paperwork, things we did not expect, totally unexpected. However, we met the challenge. Training ancillary staff, it was ongoing. We just had people within our own health department. We pulled from environmental, we pulled clerical, we just kept training. The lack of training of some of our non-pediatric nurses, we have excellent school nurses who have not given injections to an infant, and we had multi-dose vials, and to ask them to draw a 0.25, it was beyond their scope because they hadn't been doing it. So we had a lot of in-time training as much as we could fit in. However, one of our large barriers was our union restrictions. Our public health nurses are unionized. as most of our health department, in order, since this was not considered and deemed an emergency by our governor, we had a lot of constraints. So we had to go by seniority, we had to make lists, we had to really work within the guidelines of the union, which was very difficult. We got over this barrier of communicating with non-English speaking families through our Board of Ed, and we need more volunteers. We do have a Medical Reserve Corps. We need to ramp it up big time, and what we're planning on doing is, thank you, actually we're planning on getting this, the nurses are on from the hospital to hook up with it. Okay, I want to give acknowledgments to Dr. Perry for helping us out and Teresa Rabowski. And these are our public health nurses before a clinic at the... They're all real smiling, barely, just barely setting up. Everybody's happy. Thank you very much.
Are we preoccupied with the desire to come in? There, I think there were other things. question actually was actually like next year, probably this year we won't.
Okay, all right. Because I mean, because I suspect what it did. I think about being thin all the time, but I love to eat, you know, so. I never throw up. I like to eat, you know, so. Okay. But my other question is, because I have teenage sons, why do you think the boys use diuretics?
Very interesting point that Jennifer and I both were intrigued by. Interesting because we didn't really know for sure, but we did some look into the literature and found that diuretics are often used as a masking agent for steroid use.
Can you get to the microphone?
Oh, right. Yeah.
So diuretics, we found that diuretics were often used as a masking agent in steroid use in professional sports, and it potentially could be in any type of competitive bodybuilding or whatever. But interestingly, when I was talking, giving this presentation in my class, I have quite a group of young men who are into bodybuilding. And I had asked them, I said, I think it's really interesting that we see this diuretic use and we haven't had a chance to really explore it. I said, what do you guys see among your peers? And they're like, well, you don't really use diuretics. And the other guy goes, wait a minute. You know, if we're, you know, sometimes there is diuretic use. And he goes, oh, yeah, that one guy who was going out for Halloween asked to buy my diuretics. Oh, I have diuretics. I have used them, but not for that. A lot of times they're using it, from what I can gather, is for vascularity purposes and for the increased look of muscularity. So, interesting.
There wasn't a lot of research that there was a bigger gap in research looking at
men's diuretic use. Okay, I'm surprised they even knew what a diuretic was. So, I mean, I'm just saying, like, that's, you know, there they are. You know, they don't know what a vision, you know. Any loony thing somebody tells them at the gym sounds good to him. So they're using, you know, muscle milk, blah, blah, blah. But it would be hard for me to believe that the average college student male knows what a diuretic is and knows whether or not he has ever taken it in all the hoo-ha that he has taken to make his body beautiful. So
I think guys on wrestling teams take it all the time.
Of course, yeah. They do it all the time. Okay,
so I think other people find
right.
it out.
But I'd say that's intriguing.
We did control for what type of athletes, or we did not control for the type of diuretic. So it could, you know, they could perceive, oh, I'm caffeine, I use caffeine calculator.
Yeah.
So there was
Thank you very much.